rejuvenate ourselves back into a great big book study here on the weekend. It's become something special in my life, so it is great to be back for another seminar.
Good afternoon. My name is Charlie Parman. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of the power that I found in the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink for 5,671 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. And I'm like Joe, it's always great to be back in Pompano Beach for our springtime seminar especially. We look forward to this all winter. Chance to get down here and meet old friends and make new friends and get to talk about the big book and the 12 and 12 and some unity and service. And seem like this is the only place we go where we get AA as a whole in talking about all three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're certainly glad to be here, and we welcome all of you to be here also. We always like to start our particular part of this seminar by making the statement that we do not consider ourselves to be the gurus of the big book or the experts on anything. We're simply two people that met years ago, found a mutual interest in the book, have shared the book together for a long, long time, and what few things we've learned about it we love to share with other people. We do not speak for AA as a whole, and you are certainly free to agree or disagree with anything as you see fit. In fact, we would recommend that you pay no attention to anything that we would say which cannot be reconciled with what's in the big book or other conference-approved material. I might also state that if it is true that everybody in AA is sick, then you're probably today about the finest-looking bunch of sick people we've had a chance to see in a long time. We'll have a good time together this weekend. We try to keep this thing as informal as we possibly can. We realize that the mind is only going to absorb about what the rear end's going to stand. Some of these sessions become quite long. You'll be sitting for a long period of time. We know that once in a while you may feel the need to get up and move around, and if you do, please feel free to do that. If you feel the need to get up and go get yourself a cup of coffee or a glass of orange juice or whatever, please feel free to do that. If you feel the need to get up and go out to the restroom and get rid of a cup of coffee, please feel free to do that also. Let's keep it informal. Let's all have a good time and as we talk about the book. We brought with us a couple of copies of the book that some of you may be interested in seeing. We have one here which is one of the original 5,000 that was printed. You can see why this book is called The Big Book. If you'll notice, it's a very thick book. And I know Bob or Bill and Hank and those in the beginning interested in selling the book wanted to make it appear as important as they possibly could. And they printed it on some pretty thick old paper, cheap paper, and the cheaper it is, the thicker it is. And that makes you a big, thick book. If you look inside the book, open it up, you'll notice the margins on the pages are quite wide. The bigger the margins, of course, the bigger the book's going to be. And this is why it ended up being called the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, simply because of the size of the book. There's not any more in it than you got in your book today, but it certainly looks a little bit more impressive. You notice also it was red. This book has become quite a rarity now. Joe bought this one several years ago. And I've been looking for one, and I've been trying to find one, and I've been trying to buy one. In fact, I've offered Joe a 500% profit on this book. He doesn't seem to be interested in selling it to me, though, even at a 500% profit. You see, he bought this at a church book sale, and he paid the great total of 20 cents for this book. And I've offered him a dollar several times. He just refuses, though. It'll be here all weekend. If you'd like to look at it any time, please feel free to do so. This one we have here is also still a first edition, but not a first printing. This is the 12th printing. You'll notice the book, Sanity Had Returned. The book is much thinner. It's much smaller. The margins on the pages are smaller. Back in this particular era, the cover of the book was, of course, yellow and red. Finally, everything went to blue on it. These are also getting to be quite a rarity. One of the main reasons we like to bring this book is to read to you one thing out of the cover of it. It says, this book may be ordered from the publisher upon a free examination basis. Send $3.50 or instruct to send COD and pay the few extra cents money return cost. Examine for 7 days, and if not satisfied that the book will be helpful, return and money, including postage, will be refunded. I thought you might like to know that we used to give a money-back guarantee on our book. If it didn't work, you could always get your money back out of it. This one will also be here over the weekend, and if you'd like to look at either one of them, please feel free to do so anytime. Joe, you want to talk a little?
Okay. Usually at this point, I'd give a little background of the Big Book Study as far as Charlie and I are concerned. I think we began, actually, it began in my life around about 1971, late part of 71. I had a great interest in the Big Book because of the work I was involved in, working with alcoholics. And at this point in my life, although I affected my recovery for some years, I seen a great need to learn more about the Big Book in order to help people. So I began what was my study of the Big Book. It was very futile, as I know it, very frustrating. But I spent a lot of time in my study of the Big Book. I would find certain small bits of information that gave me some keys or insight into the Big Book. And I began to relate these to the local AA members as I knew them. I began to go around, and every time I met a member at a meeting, I would get around and tell him about what I was finding in the book. And I finally began to realize what was going on. I found a lot of people that weren't interested in the book. And to my knowledge, it began to dawn on me that none of them were interested. In fact, I think it became quite a thing for most of the AA people when they saw me coming was to hide. Because they know what I was going to talk about. You know, here comes that guy about the book. So, you know, it was about this time, and I think it was in 1973, after about a year of this, that I met Charlie. And Charlie and I met, it was at an Al-Anon convention of all things, an Al-Anon convention. And I was asked, we was having an Al-Anon convention there at Little Rock, and I was asked, was I introduced to the Al-Anon speaker? And I have never met Charlie. He lives way, and he'll tell you where that is, a couple hundred miles and a long ways from me. And he and his wife were going to be the speakers at the Al-Anon meeting that night. And we have a big kick about it because I introduced him that night, and I saw on the program where I was supposed to introduce a guy named Charlie P. And I told him I had to, the way I looked at it, it was kind of confusing to me. I was very disappointed when I saw him because I thought I was going to get to introduce Charlie Pride when I seen that Charlie P. And this guy wasn't even the right color. But
couldn't sing worth a damn either.
Or. Now, how's that? Good, good. Maybe you better put yours on. We'll get it all in focus here for us over with. But we had a great talk and a great meeting that night. And after the meeting that night, I remember Charlie and I was kind of standing around after everybody, you know, talked to him. And I got him over in the corner, and we got to visit. And I just pulled my favorite subject out, the Big Book, as I did on all the AA members. And when I did, I was very shocked because Charlie was very interested in what I was trying to talk about in the Big Book.
I think we actually struck a mutual relationship there, which has been something that's unbelievable, that two people could have the relationship we have. And that all the experiences we have had down through the last 10 or 12 years through the big book, because it began right there. We immediately began to set up things where we could see each other. And Charlie lives on a farm 225 miles from my house, and I would drive to the farm some weekends, and I think some of our greatest moments was sitting in his kitchen over the weekend studying the big book on the farm. We began to go from there. We would go to different conferences, and we would meet at these different conferences. We would always get away to ourselves on Saturday evening and study the big book. And this went on for quite a few months. And finally, the third person was asked. He said he was interested in setting in to learn. So we sat in, and he would sit in and listen. Finally, another one come in. Another one would want to come. And finally, we finally ended up with over 25 people sitting on the bed and on the floors doing a big book study. And this was what we thought the big book study was. It's a few people that had the interest that wanted to come into the room. And so this went on, I guess, for a year. Finally, we were asked to do someone asked us to do a big book study at their group in Lawton, Oklahoma. And this is where Charlie and I went out there, and this is where the first big book study was actually done for us in a group setting. And I believe there was 35 people there. It was taped, and through one thing or another, a series of circumstances, the tape actually laid around for 3 months or 4 months. It was never even played. I happened to guys, me and another, through the local taper, I got a hold of the tape and gave it to him, sent for it and gave it to him. And this guy took the tape and he said, "Oh, that's real good." He said, "I believe I'll put it into four little cassettes and see if somebody would like to have some of them." And this is actually what started the big book tapes. And so it's been quite an experience. And Charlie and I were just amazed that from a simple interest in the big book, that we have been to be able to be a part of so many people's lives, some of the finest people in Alcoholics Anonymous all over the world, and even in Australia. So it is one of the things our book says, you'll be going places doing things you never thought you'd be able to do. And these promises all directly through are related to the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous.
Thought you might be interested in knowing, too, that, Wesley was in Australia back a few years ago. And because of Wesley being in Australia, we ended up with some big book tapes in Australia. And then because of that experience there, John, the year before last, John Williams was in Australia talking about the big book and traditions and et cetera. And then Joe and I got to go over there last year and spend a month in various different places doing big book studies and big book seminars. Today I brought Wesley a set of four tapes from the first official big book seminar done in Australia by Australians. So the big book seminar is alive and it's going well in Australia. And Wesley will get to listen to the tapes that he originally set in motion when he went over there several years ago. So this thing is beginning to spread, and we're gradually getting the fellowship back into its own literature, back into its own book, and back into its own program. Basically through things like this where we all begin to participate. John did a great job on the history of the book, and we're not going to spend any time there hardly at all, other than to say that in order for Bill and Dr. Bob and Bill D. number 3 and the rest of the original people in AA to recover from the disease of alcoholism, they found that it was necessary for them to know basically three things. They found it was necessary for them to know what their problem really was. And before Bill and Bob, and before Dr. Silkworth, the world really didn't understand what the problem of alcoholism was. The world looked at alcoholism as a matter of being a weak-willed individual. The world looked at alcoholism as being a morally sinful bad thing. And they looked at it as being a self-imposed illness. And we know that in 1933, when Bill visited in the town's hospital, was there for treatment under Dr. Silkworth, for the first time we begin to really see what the disease is. We begin to understand that it's not just a matter of the mind. We begin to understand that it's also an illness of the body itself. And we begin to find out that the disease was a twofold disease, a physical allergy of the body coupled with a mental obsession of the mind. And both of them would have to be treated in order for us to overcome the disease of alcoholism. And probably for the first time, Bill Wilson was really the first alcoholic to understand what his problem was. We know that Bill didn't sober up on that. He left that hospital with self-knowledge about the disease, and in a relatively short period of time was drunk again. And we know that he drank from 1933 until 1934. In 1934, he went back into town's hospital under Dr. Silkworth again and was pronounced incurable. And we know that Bill left the hospital the second time, and he managed to stay sober for a period of time on fear, because Dr. Silkworth had made the statement that, you know, he's going to die from DTs, or he's going to have to be locked up in a nut house because he's going to go absolutely insane from this disease. And for a period of time, he stayed sober on fear, but we also know that in Armistice Day 1934, Bill got drunk again. And we know that during that drunk, he was visited by this fellow named Ebby, who we'll be talking about in more detail later on, the picture up here behind us on the wall. And we know that Ebby brought Bill some more ideas. He, in addition to what the disease was that Bill learned from Dr. Silkworth, Ebby brought him what they then referred to as a simple religious idea. The idea that if you are to overcome this disease, you would have to find a power greater than you are. That we had become absolutely powerless over alcohol, and the only way to overcome that was through the aid of a power greater than we are. And Ebby talked to Bill about this power. And we know that for the first time, Bill could begin to see what the solution was, that it wasn't willpower, that it had to be a power outside of human power in order to be able to overcome the disease. Ebby also brought him these little ideas from this group of first century Christianity type people, the Oxford groups. And he said, Bill, through this little planned program of action, if you would apply this in your life, you can find this power greater than you are, and then you will be able to overcome this disease of alcoholism. And for the first time in his life, Bill knew all three things. He knew what the problem was, the disease. He knew what the solution was, a power greater than human power. And now then he knew how to find that solution through a planned program of action. And we know that even while he was drinking, Bill began to try to put this planned program of action to work in his life. And we know that he finally drank himself all the way down and was back in the town's hospital with Dr. Silkworth, and Ebby came there to visit Bill. And we know that he and Ebby applied this planned program of action to the best of their ability over about a two-day period in the town's hospital in Bill's life. And Bill had what he always referred to as a vital spiritual experience as the result of that course of action. And he felt as if the great clean wind of a mountaintop had blown through and through, and his whole attitude and outlook upon life had changed. We really don't know what happened to Bill that day in 1934, except we do know that he left the hospital. And we know that he never had to drink again all the rest of his life. And we know that he didn't die until 1971. He was able to spend all of that period with never having to take another drink of alcohol. We know this is what Bill took to Dr. Bob. You know, and Dr. Bob, when Bill came to visit him for the first time in his life, knew three things. He knew the problem, and he knew the solution, and he knew the planned program of action. And we know that as the result of that, Dr. Bob recovered from the disease, never to have to drink again as long as he lived. We know that these two fellows took this immediately to another guy in the city hospital in Akron, a fellow named Bill D. And we know that they told him three things. What is the problem? What is the solution? And how do you find the solution? And as a result of that, Bill D sobered up to never have to drink again. And we know that eventually, over a period of time, 40 of them had sobered up, as John said. And by 1937, it became apparent that they had found perhaps the answer to the disease of alcoholism. And as John explained to us, they made decisions on what to do with this. And they were going to build the hospitals, and they were going to build the treatment centers, and they were going to hire the missionaries, and they were going to write the book. Well, thank God, only one of those things came true. They did write the book. You know, and the purpose of the book was to show other alcoholics how those first 40 had recovered from their disease. And we'll find out as we study the book this weekend that it follows that same pattern. It's going to tell us what is the problem, and then it's going to tell us what is the solution, and it's going to show us exactly how to find that solution. And by the time they had the book written in 1939, 60 more of them had sobered up, and there was now 100. And all of the first 100 knew those three things. What is the problem? What is the solution? And how do you find the solution? We've always said when we find a reason to study the table of contents in the big book, that we would start studying the table of contents. And we think that we have. So with your permission, we're going to start today with the table of contents. And in your handout sheets that you have in the little white thing you picked up, there will be sheets corresponding with some of the things that we're going to be discussing. And the first one of those that you have, the sheet one, will be representing the table of contents and how the book is broken down into these three areas. Joe?
Okay, look at the table of contents. We say our book says, you know, it talks about the main purpose of the book. And the book is written in purposes, we say goals, or it has certain objectives. And the first goal of the big book is to show you what is the problem. Now, that is the basis of recovery. That's the foundation of recovery from alcoholism, or the foundation of recovery from anything, is what is the problem. That's the first information you got to have in solving a problem. And until that is done, nothing can be done. You know, that's the first thing we do in the case of any illness, is to diagnose it, to find out what is the problem. That is the basic information. Now, once we learn that information, what the problem is, the problem is what determines the solution. So that has got to be done first. So the problem is step one, which is a problem statement. The problem is he's powerless over alcohol and his life has become unmanageable. The section of the textbook that shows it, that is going to give us the information on the problem, is the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. These two pieces of materials will show us the exact nature of the problem. And always, we look at alcoholism as a unique illness. It's one of the only illnesses in the world in which the victim has to make a self-diagnosis, and that's what makes it hard. You know, alcoholism by its nature is very difficult to diagnose. I say that, you know, And it's the only illness that tells the victim he ain't got it. You know, you can tell. Every alcoholic ain't got it. In fact, that's about the only way you can tell who's got it. The one that ain't got it's got it. Now, if you ask one of them social drinkers, is he an alcoholic? He say, I might be. He ain't got it. It's the one that ain't got it. Okay. Now, once we find the problem, then we can determine, then we can write a prescription. Once the doctor diagnoses you and finds the problem, then he can write the prescription. Now, the solution, there is a solution, more about alcoholism and we agnostics. These three chapters will help you find the solution to alcoholism. Step two, since the problem is powerless, if the problem is powerless, the solution would have to be power. Okay. So we established the problem and the solution. Now, simply we have established to the alcoholic where he is, exactly where he is.
Step one.
And once we determine where he is, then the second step determines we believe you ought to, based on where you are, we believe you ought to be over here. So we establish another point. We establish two points. We establish where you are and where we want to go. Now the third and final and main purpose of the book, How It Works, Into Action and Work With Others, is our step-by-step plan of going from point one to point two. And these are the 10 steps of recovery. Now, this is why the program is precise, it's specific, and it's clear-cut. As we lay one, the first step has to be met before we can have the second step. These two steps have to be in place before we can carry out the plan of recovery.
As an example of that, let's say that you were on the way to this seminar and you were driving here and you were out on the freeway somewhere and your car stopped running and you pulled it over to the side of the road. Well, on the surface, your problem is that your car stopped running. But that really isn't your problem. Your problem is, why did it stop running? Because you can get out and work on that car all day long, and until you've determined why it stopped running, you'll never be able to fix it. And let's say you know a little something about troubleshooting procedures, and you decide to get out and troubleshoot the car to determine why it isn't running. And you check out the electrical system, and you check out the fuel system. It's almost got to be one of those two. And sure enough, you find that you have a bad coil in your car, and because of that, you're not getting fire to the spark plugs. Well, for the first time, you really know what your problem is. The coil is bad, and because of the bad coil, the car won't run. But you're still not any better off than you were before, because you're still standing there at the side of the car. Now that you know why it's not running, you still haven't fixed it. So now then, we're going to have to determine, well, what is the solution? And in that particular case, of course, the solution is relatively simple: to get a new coil and put it in the car in place of the old one. But you're still not any better off than you were before, because you're still standing there at the side of the car. You know what's wrong. You know what you need to do. So now then, we got to figure out a plan, a program of action. How in the world am I going to get a new coil, because I'm out here in the middle of the country standing at the side of the road? Am I going to hitchhike to town? Am I going to walk back to that house I saw? Am I going to make a phone call and have somebody bring me a coil? You know, how am I going to get this thing? Well, when we finally figure out a planned program of action and we carry it out and we get a new coil back to the car, and then we put the new coil in and step in and hit the starter, and sure enough, it fires up and now it runs, well, we've solved the problem. But we had to know three things in order to do that. And this is true with all problem solving. Irregardless of what it is, we've got to know three things. What is the problem? What is the solution? And how do you find the solution? And the big book lays it out just exactly like the first three or the first 100 people had to know, showing us the problem in the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, showing us the solution in chapter 2, 3, and 4, and then telling us how to find the solution in chapters 5, 6, and 7. Now, I think if we'll bear that in mind as we go through this thing this weekend, we'll be able to see this certain sequence develop in the book and how one thing leads to another, and we almost have to start at the beginning and able to really see the pattern of the book. Okay, let's go over for just a moment to the preface. Somebody needs to turn that off. In the preface, mine will read just a little bit differently than yours, because I happen to have a second edition in front of me, and mine will say this is the second edition of the book, where yours will probably say this is the third edition. But after the first paragraph, then it reads the same. Starting out, mine says, this is the second edition of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, which made its first appearance in April of 1939. More than 300,000 copies of the first edition are now in circulation. But then it reads, because this book has become the basic text for our society and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has been left largely untouched. And in looking at that paragraph, we think there's two ideas that we need to look at for a moment. Number one, because this book has become the basic text for our society. And when we read the words basic text, I think we're alerted to the type book that we have in front of us. You know, there's all kind of different books. There's biographies and there's autobiographies. All different kinds of novels. There's novels written on fact and novels written on fiction and etc. Probably a novel is the book that we're most familiar with. We probably read more of those than anything else. And if a novel is written correctly, in the beginning of the novel, it will introduce the characters in the book, and it will outline the story plot. And as we proceed through the novel and it introduces more and more people and more plot, a novel becomes a very exciting thing. And if the author's really good, he can hold our attention all the way through. And we reach the end of the novel, and if they end like I like for them to, they all rode off into the sunset together holding hands and had their white hats on, and they lived happily ever after. You know, Rebecca, Sunnybrook Farms, and things like this are novels. Usually when we read a novel, chances are we'll probably won't read it anymore. There may be a day come when it's a cold, rainy day, we got nothing to do, we're looking for something to read. We look over the bookshelf, we see the novel back on the bookshelf, and we remember it was good, and we may take it down and read it a second time. If we do, chances are that'll be the last time we'll read it. But now a textbook is something entirely different. You know, most of us remember textbooks from the days when we went to school. None of us particularly liked them at all, because they usually meant work. They meant you had to read and study and try to memorize and had to work problems and fill out answer sheets and etc. And usually took us into work we really didn't like to do. But if we used a textbook and used it correctly, we could learn things from that textbook. You know, a textbook is a teaching tool. Now, people don't like the word teaching, but teaching is a very simple thing. Teaching is nothing more than taking ideas from one person's mind and transmitting them in some manner to the mind of another person. And it can be done by the written word, it can be done through pictures, it can be done by oral talking, or combinations of all three of those. And it's simply nothing more than transmitting ideas. A textbook is a book that takes this information from the mind of one human being, puts it down in the written form, and transmits it to the mind of the other human being. And by doing that, the other human being gains knowledge they didn't have before. A textbook almost always assumes that the reader has a very limited amount of knowledge about the subject matter. Always starts at a very simple place. And then as you progress through the textbook and you gain and learn information, then new information is added on. And gradually as you progress through the book, the information becomes more and more complicated, but the knowledge becomes greater and greater. Let's say that we had a textbook on mathematics. And I took this textbook on mathematics and I took it to my friend Joe. Now, I've got to remember that Joe knows nothing at all about mathematics. Joe can't even add and subtract. He can count to 21 if he's standing there naked and got everything where it's supposed to be. You know. I said that one day, and he said, "Nah, Charlie, 20 and a half is about all I can do." And I hand this textbook to Joe on mathematics, and I say, "Joe, I want you to go to chapter 5, and you'll find algebra problems there, and I want you to work those algebra problems." And Joe opens up the book, and he goes to chapter 5, and he sees the algebra problems. And he can't even add and subtract. They're just so much Greek to him. Chances are he'll close the book, lay it on the shelf, and may not ever pick it up again. But if I say, "Joe, in this textbook on mathematics, the first chapter deals with addition and subtraction. And if you will read and study that chapter and ask any questions that you need, I'll be glad to help you understand. By the time you reach the end of that first chapter, you should be able to work those sample problems dealing with addition and subtraction. And sure enough, Joe does this. And through asking questions and through me helping him understand and through the working of the problems, he learns how to add and subtract. And I say, now, Joe, you go to chapter 2, and it deals with multiplication and division. And based on what you learned in 1, now then you can accept the new information and absorb it out of chapter 2, and you'll learn how to multiply and divide. Knowing, of course, that he'll have to have guidance and help as he goes through that. When he reaches the end of chapter 2, he knows how to multiply and divide. And I say, now, Joe, chapter 3 deals with fractions and decimals. And based on what you learned in 1 or 2, you can now absorb this new information in chapter 3. And gradually, we take him through the first 4 chapters, and we get to chapter 5. I say, now, what you've learned in 1, 2, 3, and 4 will give you the information necessary to absorb the new information in 5, and you should be able to read it, understand it, and learn how to work those problems dealing with algebra. This is the standard textbook theory on any information. Doesn't make any difference what it is. We think one of the greatest mistakes being made in AA today is the newcomer walks in the door and we hand him a copy of the big book and we say, go to chapter 5 and do what it says and you'll be okay. And he goes to chapter 5 and he opens it up and he looks at it and all he sees is a bunch of algebra problems. Impossible for him to work those problems because the first one says, admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Well, he's never admitted he's powerless over anything in his life, you know. And if he can't admit he's powerless, then he certainly don't need a power greater than himself to restore him to sanity. And if he doesn't need that, then he doesn't have to make a decision between the two. Chances are he'll close the book up and lay it on the shelf, and it may be a long time before he looks at it again. We believe that all the information necessary for steps 1 and 2 will be found in the doctor's opinion in the first 3 chapters. We hope to be able to show that this weekend. The preliminary information necessary to be able to go to chapter 5 and start dealing then with steps 3 through 11. The other idea in this particular paragraph is that because this book has become the basic text for our society and helps such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has been left largely untouched. Now, we know the big book has had 3 editions. Number 1 is the big red book that's here in front of us. Number 2 was the book that I happen to have in front of me that was printed and came out in 1955. Number 3, probably the one that most of you have today, the 3rd edition that came out in 1976. And the only changes that's been made in the book are the stories in the back of the book. We know that by 1955 it became apparent that the stories in the back of the book, which were put there for the new person to identify with, those stories no longer were accurately reflecting the membership of Alcoholics Anonymous by the time the early 1950s came around. Most of the original members were low bottom drunks. All of them but one was a man, and most of them were in their 50s. But by the early 1950s, this picture had changed radically. Average age was going down and down. Bottom was coming up and up. And the percentage between male and female was changing quite radically. And they found that it was necessary to change stories in the back of the book to more accurately reflect the membership. This they did in 55. They deleted some of the old ones, added in some new ones, and came out with a 2nd edition. But the first 164 pages remained the same, the recovery section. The same thing happened in 1976. By the early 1970s, average age was getting way down in the 40s. We know that the ratio between men and women had become about 2 to 1. And we know that bottom was becoming higher and higher. So again, in the 1970s, they found it necessary to come out with a 3rd edition, changing stories in the back of the book. But the first 164 pages, the recovery program remained the same. And it means a lot to me today. Because
even we, irrational, power-driving alcoholics, have never found it necessary to change our recovery program since this thing first appeared in 1939. And literally millions of alcoholics had recovered from the disease of alcoholism through the use of this recovery program. And it didn't make any difference whether I'm reading first edition, second edition, or third edition. The same recovery program applies today that applied back in 1939 when the book was first printed. Let's look at the foreword of the first edition for just a moment. In the foreword of the first edition, it tells us we were more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And again, two little ideas. Number one, we're more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless condition of mind and body. And when I read that, it alerts me to the fact that I'm not dealing with a book that is authored by one human being. Now, we know that Bill wrote the book, but we can also tell from the history that John did earlier today, that all of these first people were involved in this book. And we know that they reserved the right to examine Bill's writings. And we know that Bill sent this information around to Dr. Bob and other members. And we know that they fought, and we know that they argued about it. And we know that when it was to be done, it was to be the collective knowledge, experience, and wisdom of the first 100, not just Bill himself. So the book itself is not a one-person, one-author book. It is really authored by the first 100 people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, those 100 people have recovered from the same thing that's tearing me up if I'm a practicing alcoholic. And it's a hell of a lot more hard for me to argue with 100 of them than it would be with one. You know, if I read a book that is authored by one person, with my keen intellectual alcoholic mind, I usually say, well, who in the hell is he to think he's smarter than I am? And I ignore what he has to say. But if I do that with the big book, I'm going to be arguing with 100 people who have recovered from this disease that's killing me, and it's a little harder for me to do that. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Now, we've been around AA long enough to know that there are no rules in AA. There are no musts in AA. There's nothing that you have to do in AA. In fact, the only requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous is a desire to stop drinking. You know, you don't have to do anything to be a member. In fact, you can come to an AA meeting and say, I don't like you people. Sure as hell don't like your book. Don't like your program, not going to work it. But you make a fairly good cup of coffee, and I'm going to keep coming back because I've got a desire to stop drinking. And there's nothing we can do about that because he's fulfilled the membership requirement. In fact, you don't even have to be sober to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It helps if you are, you know, but you certainly don't have to be. But those statements are all dealing with the requirement to be a member of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, if we are to recover from the disease of Alcoholics Anonymous, as the first 100 did, then they have shown us in the big book precisely how that was accomplished. And if we would like to recover like they did, chances are there might be some things there that we will need to do. You know, it's kind of like making a cake. Let's say you and I go to one of our great potluck meetings. And at that potluck meeting, somebody brought a strawberry cake, and that's my favorite cake. And this cake is just exactly the right texture, the right moisture content, the right flavor, and the icing is perfect. And man, I take a bite of that, and it just melts in my mouth, and I can't wait to find out who made that cake. Now, you being a good cook will certainly claim that you made it. And I say, would you write me out a recipe for that cake? And you say, well, sure, be glad to. And you sit down and you write a recipe for the cake, and you give me a precise plan of action necessary to make that cake.
And what you give me, you tell me the exact ingredients to go in that cake. And you tell me the exact sequence to mix them together in. And you tell me the exact temperature at which to bake it. And you tell me exactly how long to bake it. Now, I take it home to my kitchen, and I use your set of instructions, and I follow them precisely. I use the same identical ingredients in the same quantities. I mix them in the same sequence. I bake them at the same temperature for exactly the same length of time. And I take the cake out of the oven, I set it over here on the cabinet, and I let it cool off. And after a while, I go take me a bite of that cake. Now, I can expect it to taste exactly like yours did. And if I followed your instructions, it probably will. But if, with my keen intellectual alcoholic mind, I say, well, now, you know, I really don't think it needs three eggs, it just needs two. Or probably it ought to have 2.5 cups of sugar instead of 1.5 cups. Or I really think it ought to be baked for 45 minutes instead of 30. And it ought to be 425 degrees instead of 350. But when I get through with that thing and take it out of the oven and set it over on the cabinet and let it cool off, and I take a bite of it, certainly I'm going to be taking a bite of a piece of cake. But I wonder how closely it would resemble the cake that you had made before. If we would like to recover as the first 100 people did, we have a precise recipe in the Big Book for recovery. It has nothing to do with being a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a precise method for recovery from the disease that the first 100 followed. And if I follow it precisely, then I could expect the same identical results that they received themselves. Joe?
Okay. Follow to the second edition. Roman numeral, page 15, last paragraph. The spark that was to flare in the first AA group was struck at Akron, Ohio in June 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience. Following a meeting with an alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford group that day. He had been greatly helped by the late Dr. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism, who is now accounted no less than a medical saint by a group and whose story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. Now, right here, we see in this paragraph really the three things that it took for Bill to recover. He met Dr. Silkworth, from whom he got the problem. He met met Ebby, who brought him the solution. And he talked about the Oxford group of that day who had the plan of recovery. From this doctor, the broker had learned the grave nature of alcoholism. Although he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group, he was convinced of the need for a moral inventory of professional personality defects, restitution of those harmed, helpless to others, and the necessity of belief in a dependence upon God. Prior to his journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic. But he succeeded only in keeping sober himself. And this was during the time that Bill, after he'd recovered, he'd worked with a lot of alcoholics, and he went around trying to give them the recovery plan. He went around trying to give them chapters 5, 6, and 7. He went around trying to give them his spiritual experience. It didn't work because he didn't give them the other two pieces. Just before that, the broker had gone to Akron on a business venture, which collapsed. And just before going there is when he had Dr. Silkworth talk to him about it. Dr. Silkworth told him that, "You need to start telling these people what I told you first, and then maybe they'll buy into your program." He suddenly realized in order to save himself, he must carry this message to another alcoholic. This alcoholic turned to be the Akron physician. Now, the physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to solve his alcoholic dilemma, but had failed. Now, remember, as the story goes, and there was some passing on and throughout that, it talks about Dr. Bob. Now, Dr. Bob was in the Oxford groups in Akron, Ohio. and he was going to the Oxford Group meetings, and there was a lot of five or six people that had a meeting there every Sunday. And they would sit around in a meeting of the Oxford Groups, and they would have their little discussions and talk about what God had done with them, and they would share their shortcomings. You wouldn't see where our steps actually came from. And they were, as they were in this group each Sunday, Henrietta was in the group, and she was she got kind of angry because, as she said it, you know, Dr. Bob, she knew Dr. Bob had a serious problem with alcohol, and they would all discuss their problems. But Dr. Bob wouldn't never say nothing about his. He just sat there. He was a hidden drunk. In other words, he was a doctor, and he did his drinking at home, and when he got home, and he had quite a problem, but he would hide it. And told Ann, said she called up and said, "Now I'm just getting tired of him coming, not saying nothing. If he don't say nothing this week, you be prepared. We're gonna bring it up to him." And sure enough, as they went around that Sunday sharing their shortcomings, it got to Dr. Bob, and he was the last one. And Dr. Bob said, "Well, you people have been so good in sharing yourself with me." He said, "I'm gonna share something that might cost me my career." He said, "I have a serious problem with drinking, and I can't stop." Somebody said, "Well, Dr. Bobby wants to pray for you." And he said, "Yes." And somebody else sat down on their knees. So these six people in the Oxford Group in Akron got on their knees and started praying for help for Dr. Bob. And this was many weeks before Bill came to Akron. They hadn't met. One other thing that went home as Henrietta says, she went home that night on a Sunday night. One of the customs of the people in the Oxford Groups, they could receive guidance from God. And this was the early beginning of our prayer, our step 11, but it came from the Oxford Groups, and they would receive guidance from God. And as the custom in the group, not only could you receive direct guidance from God, but you could also receive guidance for another member of the group.
A lot of them still trying it today, too.
So Henrietta was in her kitchen, and she got a message. She said right within her mind, she got the message. Something just said to her, said, "Dr. Bob should not drink any more whiskey, not even one drop." Well, you know, they didn't know anything about it. They hadn't heard the first step, so it didn't have any meaning. That was the answer. But she says, "What does that mean?" Well, she did. She called Dr. Bob up immediately and said, "Come over here. I want to talk to you tomorrow morning." So Dr. Bob came over Monday morning, and she said, "Dr. Bob, I got a message from you from God." He said, "What is it?" He said, "You shouldn't drink any more whiskey, not even one drop." And Dr. Bob said, "What does that mean?" Well, they didn't know, but they continued to pray for Dr. Bob. Now, this was many weeks before Bill came, and Henrietta always said, when she picked up the phone, and this guy from New York said who he was and what he was all about, she knew that this phone call was the answer to the prayers of the people in the Oxford Groups. Now remember, Dr. Bob was in the Oxford Groups. Dr. Bob knew the second step, which he knew the solution to alcoholism. He knew the planned program of action. He had the program of the Oxford Groups, and he knew the solution. But he couldn't affect it because he didn't know the problem. And when Bill came and brought him Dr. Silkworth's description of the problem, he said the physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma but had failed. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and his hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy of his malady with a willingness he had never before been able to muster. He sobered never to drink again to the moment of his death in 1950. Bill bought him the other piece of the puzzle. Here's the two men set about frantically upon alcoholics arriving in the ward at the Akron City Hospital. Their very first case, a desperate one, recovered immediately and became AA number 3. He never drank again. Just working at Akron continued through the summer of 1935. There were many failures, but there was an occasional heartening success. When the broker returned to New York in the fall of 1935, the first AA group had actually been formed, though no one realized it at this time. The second group second small group promptly took shape at New York to be followed in 1937 and started with a third at Cleveland. Besides these, there were scattered alcoholics who had picked up the basic ideas in Akron or New York, who were trying to form groups in other cities. By the late 1935, the number of members having substantially sobriety time behind them was sufficient to convince the membership that a new light had entered the dark world of the alcoholic. It was now in time the struggling group thought to place their message and unique experience before the world. This determination bore fruit in the spring of 1939 by publication of this volume. The membership had reached about 100 men and women. The fledgling society, which had been nameless, now began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of this book. Here's a point, you know, that our fellowship actually took its name from the book. And so actually we have two Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't have one alcohol. We have two Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, in 1939, both of these were the same. That is, the people in the fellowship Alcoholics Anonymous practiced the program in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. They were basically the same. And you know, it's very peculiar that with the chronic cases of alcoholism, the people in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous using the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, 75% of the people coming into program recovery. 75% of them.
Extreme low bottom drunks.
Now what happened? What happens to people? People change. Fellowships change. Now, the original AA program in the book has not changed, as Charlie said. Thank God it's the same. But as the fellowship began to grow and spread across the country, we begin to add to, take out, delete, decorate, until where you can't hardly recognize it sometimes. You know, it's just like another program that we, you know, many of us are familiar with. You can go down to one of those places on Sunday morning, and you listen to their program and then read their book. It don't sound like the same outfit. And this is what has happened in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Go to meetings and don't drink, you know. Just come to the meetings. Take some and leave some. All these things have watered down, and we have gotten away from the real program in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that this is what is so exciting about these weekends, and we can go back to the original program of the first 100 and regenerate ourselves into what really worked for them.
You know, the thing that kind of blows our mind today is to think that Bill Wilson, who was a conman, lying, manipulating, New York City stockbroker, could walk in and talk to this well-known surgeon and explain to that surgeon the exact nature of his illness. You know, normally the surgeon would have said, well, who in the hell are you to be telling me what's wrong with my mind and my body? But what Bill had to carry to him had such depth that immediately Dr. Bob could recognize that as his problem. You see, prior to that, he thought it was weak will. He thought it was a matter of morals, and he thought it was a self-imposed disease. And he already knew the answer. He already knew the solution. He already knew the program of action. But he had never been able to apply it to the depth necessary to recover because he didn't know what his problem was. And this old New York City stockbroker explained that to him. And then based upon that, he recovered from the disease also. I thought there's got to be a guiding force somewhere, you know, that put these two guys together. Okay, let's go look at the problem. We've talked about it. We've talked around it. And if that is the thing we're going to have to know first in order to recover, let's start looking at what the problem really is. And let's start looking at the problem based upon the way it was laid out to Bill in 1933 by this fellow named Dr. Silkworth. Now, we all
you know, with some reverence look at Dr. Silkworth today. And if we aren't careful, we think that he must have really been set out to really do something about this disease of alcoholism. But he really didn't. You've got to remember, this was back during the Depression. Jobs were hard to find for everybody, including doctors. And Dr. Silkworth didn't have any place to work. And he had heard about the opportunity for a little job at the town's hospital in New York City, where they treat drunks. And they would pay him approximately $50 a week if he'd go there and go to work. So he went there simply because he was looking for a job. But while there, in working with drunks, he began to discover certain things that they had in common. And he began to discover there was some driving force behind these people that caused them to be unable to live without drinking alcohol. And he discovered there was some force behind them that caused them to be unable to stop drinking after they had taken a drink. He began to see that most cases had certain things in common. And he began then to develop some ideas about the fact, well, maybe it's more than just weak will. Or maybe it's different than a self-imposed disease. Now, we don't know how many people he gave this information to. But we know that Bill was probably the first one to really hear this information that came from the doctor. And when Bill went there for treatment, the doctor sat down with him and explained to him his opinion regarding the disease of alcoholism. And when Bill affected his recovery, and then the rest of the first 100 did, they felt that this was so important that it had to be incorporated in this information, because they had to know that in order to recover. So let's see what it was that the doctor really told Bill Wilson regarding his disease, that Bill learned what his problem was from that information.
I think sometimes, again, we around in AA, we don't really get in depth in the work of Dr. Silkworth and the role that it did play and what it does mean to Alcoholics Anonymous. It actually is the first step. So therefore, it is the foundation of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the foundation of our recovery. And this came from Dr. Silkworth. You know, when we have a problem, just like we have the problem of cancer, now that we're very hasty that we might say that we are actually hunting for a solution to cancer. But the research is not hunting for the solution to cancer. The research is directed at what is cancer. If we could find what it was, then we could develop the solution. Dr. Silkworth was a person who found the nature of alcoholism. He was the first person, because prior to Dr. Silkworth, the world didn't understand alcoholism. And when we as mankind don't understand the problem, then we're a victim of that problem. We had been since the beginning of time. None of the minds understood alcoholism. Many great minds, we had treated it in many other different ways. And this is the only thing we were doing, was trying to shoot in the dark, because we didn't understand it. You know, we can go back to the beginning of time and we can see many great statements about this in the Bible about alcohol. I love the work of Solomon. You know, they came to him and they asked him in Proverbs about probably one of us back in those days. And they didn't have number wine back. Everybody was a wino back in those days. You know? And they asked old Solomon, and he was a man, he was on top of his game. You know, he was a social worker of his day. He answered all the problems. And they asked him, they said, what about these people? And he said, you know, beware of the wine. As it moves to the right in the cup, it's pretty, it's ribbed, it's light, it's bite like a serpent, it's stinging like an owl. And he went on to describe us exactly, beautifully, a beautiful description. He said, you know, you'll be as one who lies down in the midst of a sea. You know, you sway around a lot. I sleep at the top of a mast, and I watch the mast, you know, swaying on the ship. And he said, you will say they have beaten me, and I felt it not. The next morning, you feel like somebody had been beating on you. And he said, he sure knew us fellows, because he said, thine eyes shall behold strange women. and thy heart shall utter perverse things. He said, you'll say a lot of things you don't want to say. But then he had made a very profound statement, and I love it, because he said, and still yet, they rise in the morning, and they seek it yet again. You know, that description of alcoholism, talking about wisdom in the Bible of Solomon, that would fit the alcoholics of our time. It hasn't changed one bit. But he didn't understand the problem, and none of the great minds down to Dr. Silkworth understood alcoholism. And it's very peculiar how I can see why we had so many misconceptions about alcoholism until before Alcoholics Anonymous. See, when an alcoholic had a problem, you know, we had since the beginning of times, alcoholics have had problems. Now, it's very peculiar. The people who were trying to find out, see, one out of ten people that drink have become alcoholic. And it's very peculiar. We can see what the confusion was. It was the nine people who could drink. It was the nine non-alcoholics who were trying to discover what was wrong with the alcoholic. The alcoholic didn't care. They were trying to... All of the conceptions of alcoholism that we know today, all the ignorant misconceptions of alcoholism were developed by the non-alcoholic. You know, Dr. Silkworth was the first person to say, you know, he was the first person to give us a logical explanation. There was a few doctors before that said it was a disease, but Dr. Silkworth was the first person to prove it was a disease and to show us how it worked. And it said in the front of the big book, of all places where it was published and given to the world, this is front of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's the basis for our book. Now, Dr. Silkworth saw this force, and he was able to divide this. He saw this driving force. And he began to think about this force being a twofold thing. This thing that drives these people back to this same old thing, and he divided it into a physical allergy and a mental obsession. This is the force of destruction. On page 24 of Roman numerals, the physician who at our request gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement he confirms that we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. And this is a statement that we need to look at. You know, we know that the human being actually is a tri-dimensional creature. We're going to be talking about that this weekend. The three dimensions of man. You know, we all have a spiritual life. We have a mental life, and we have a physical life. Most of our professionals in working with people, the people problems, we have developed experts, really our professionals, in these three general areas. We have people that treat our physical being, people that treat our mental being, and people that treat our spiritual being. You know, most time when a man has a problem, we find out in which department it is and then send him to the specialist in that given area. And it worked fine for everybody but alcoholics. We would have to be different. This is why they were never able to help alcoholism, because they couldn't see it as, always looked at it as a singular problem. You know, we know that back in those old days before Alcoholics Anonymous, we say a lot of drunks were killed by them doctors beating them on the knees with them little rubber hammers. And then they sent him over to the psychiatrist. And then he said, I ain't in my department. And then they sent him over to the preacher. But Dr. Silkworth says that this is a dual problem. It's a problem of the body and the mind. And later on, our book is going to be talking about, in order to recover, we're going to have to bring in the spiritual. So we're going to be talking this weekend about all the three dimensions of human life. Okay, it did not satisfy us to tell we could not control our drinking just because we were mild adjusted to life. This is the mind. We were in full flight from reality, or outright mental defectives. These were true to some extent, in fact, a considerable extent with some of us. Okay, we have, maybe the mental is very considerable, but we are sure that our bodies are sickened as well. In our belief, any picture which leads out to physical factor is incomplete. It's the only major illness that affects the body and the mind.
The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. And here we begin to see the word allergy entering the picture. And if we are to assume, as we have, that this is a textbook, and the purpose of a textbook is to transmit information from one mind to another, then we also would have to recognize that the information that's transmitted and received will be based upon our interpretation of the words that we read. And we're going to find one of the problems with the book is many of the words that we read, we do not necessarily understand it as Bill and the original people and Dr. Silkworth understood. For instance, when I look at the word allergy, it isn't hard for me to determine what an allergy is. Now, I've seen it all my life. I've known that if you got an allergy, then you're going to have some kind of physical reaction to it, and it will be manifested in some way where you can see it. For instance, if you're allergic to strawberries and you eat them, you break out in a rash. Everybody knows about that. If you're allergic to milk and you drink it, normally you have stomach cramps and a bad case of dysentery. If you're allergic to ragweeds and you get around them, your eyes itch, your nose itches, they begin to run and you begin to sneeze. And everybody knows about those allergies. They are a physical sign, a physical manifestation to whatever we're allergic to. Now I came in AA and they said, well, you're allergic to alcohol. And I said, hell, I can't be, because I've been drinking it for 26 years. And the last several, about a fifth a day. And I don't break out in a rash when I drink alcohol. Once in a while, I had a bad case of dysentery, depending on what I'd been drinking the week or so before. But I couldn't understand how they could consider me allergic to alcohol, because I didn't understand what the physical manifestation was. And we find that in order to understand this word allergy, we have to go to the dictionary and look it up. And we go to the dictionary and look the word allergy up, and it has a definition, says that it is an abnormal reaction to any food, beverage, or substance. The abnormal reaction to strawberries is a rash. To milk, it's dysentery. To ragweeds, it's the runny, itchy eyes and the sneezing. Now, what is the abnormal reaction to alcohol? In order for me to determine what my abnormal reaction would be, I would first have to determine what's normal. And to my amazement, I didn't know what was normal. I thought what was normal was what I did and what people who drank like I do did. But I begin to look around and question people, and I find that the majority of the people that drink alcohol do not react to alcohol the way I did. In fact, 9 people out of 10 react to alcohol entirely different than I did. And I started talking to these normal social drinkers, or I think the big book refers to them as temperate drinkers. And I asked them to describe to me how they felt whenever they took a drink of alcohol. And they usually tell me something like this. They say, well, we can go home from work and we can be tired and tense and all wrought up over the day's business, and we can have a drink or two before dinner and get a warm, comfortable, relaxing feeling and unwind and have dinner and probably won't drink any more that evening. Well, I don't understand that kind of drinking. In the first place, I put alcohol in my system. I don't get a warm, comfortable, relaxing feeling. When it passes my lips begin to tingle and feel hot just as soon as it goes across them. And my teeth begin to chatter up and down when it passes through them. And my cheeks begin to go in and out. And it hits my tongue, and my tongue begins to swell. And it passes up through my sinus cavities, and I get a feeling up here in my forehead which is absolutely indescribably wonderful. And I haven't even swallowed the damn stuff yet. I just got it in my mouth. You know. As it passes down through my esophagus, I can feel it, and my chest begins to grow and expand and get bigger and bigger and bigger. And it hits my stomach, and it explodes like a bomb, and it rushes out through my arms, and they get longer and longer. And it hits my hands and my fingers, and they begin to tingle and vibrate. And as it's going through my arms, I feel it passing through my legs, and I feel me getting taller and taller and taller. And it strikes the bottom of my feet, and they get a hot, intense, burning, exciting feeling, and they want to get up and go somewhere and do something. Now, I don't understand a warm, comfortable, relaxing feeling. We find out now that when the normal temperate drinker drinks alcohol, they have a built-in warning system in their body. Alcohol is a toxic thing to the body. It really is a destroyer of human tissue. And anything that will destroy the body normally has built-in warning systems that warn you you're doing something that's not good for it. And the normal social drinker, they take one, two, three drinks of alcohol, and they get a little out of control, slightly tipsy, nauseating feeling after one or two or three drinks. And they really don't like that feeling too greatly. And they say, well, I don't want to drink anymore. Now, all my life, I thought those people used willpower to not drink anymore because they didn't want to get drunk and sick and in all kinds of trouble. But I find out they don't have to use willpower, because one, two, or three drinks with a slightly tipsy, out-of-control, nauseating feeling, and that's all they want to drink. We've just recently learned that normal social drinkers drink all they drink every time they drink. All they drink, all they want to drink every time they drink. They don't have to use willpower to not drink more than that, because that's really all they want. Now, I'm different. When I put a drink in my system, it seems to trigger something that demands that I have a second drink. I don't get that slightly tipsy, out of control, slightly nauseating feeling. I get an in control feeling. And if I ever did get the nauseating feeling, I just had to puke a few times and I drank right on by that. I learned how to handle that at a very early age. When I drink alcohol, there is a craving produced in my system, which makes it virtually impossible for me not to take a second drink. And as soon as I take a second drink, I have to have a third drink. And then a fourth, and a fifth, and a sixth, and a seventh, and an eighth, and a ninth, and a tenth, and on and on and on until I'm drunk and I'm sick and in all kinds of trouble. Now, the only difference between normal and abnormal is what do the majority of the people do? If 9 people out of 10 drink it this way, and 1 person out of 10 drinks it that way, then that 1 person is considered to be abnormal when it comes to alcohol. Therefore, he is considered to be allergic to alcohol itself. And we're going to see in the doctor's opinion that my manifestation of the allergy is not breaking out in a rash, nor is it dysentery, nor is it sneezing. It is a craving in me, in both the bodily and the mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for me to stop after I once start. That does not happen to the normal drinker. All those years, all my life, I thought the normal drinker used willpower to not drink more than 1, 2, or 3 drinks. Now today I realize they don't crave alcohol after they take the first drink. I crave alcohol after I take the first drink.
Come back. Whatever you say.
Let's take a 15-minute break, okay? Okay, let's go to Roman numeral page 26. And we'll look at what the doctor had to say regarding this physical allergy that we have to alcohol. Joe?
We believe, as so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of the allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergy types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon human things, their problems pile up and they become astonishingly difficult to solve. Now he's saying that the action of the alcoholic on the abnormal reaction, what is abnormal in the alcoholic as compared to the normal alcoholic is the craving of alcohol. And it never occurs in the other group of people. The average temperate drinker does not crave alcohol. This is why they drink like they do. And as Charlie says, and this is what is so confusing to the alcoholic, to we alcoholics. We alcoholics, those of us, I know myself, I only speak of myself as an alcoholic. I didn't know that I was an abnormal drinker because I had been an abnormal drinker all my life. And when you're an abnormal drinker all your life, abnormal drinking is normal to you. And I drank with other abnormal drinkers. So my alcoholic life was a perfectly normal one, he says. But now I realize my drinking was very abnormal. And what the single point that makes me abnormal was that I craved alcohol once I took a drink, and normal people do not crave alcohol. Charlie was talking about this a few weeks ago, and I guess it was a few weeks ago, he made a trip to Denver. And he said on the way back, you know, every once in a while it just bugs the hell out of him. It bugs me all the time about these social drinkers. I like to watch them in close on the airplanes. That's the best place to watch them, you know. Because you got them in close, you know, and you can really get a good eyeball on them. And watch what they're doing. It's the most fascinating thing. You know, they get one of them little bottles, as Charlie says, they have to squeeze it. They can't get it all out. Ain't but an ounce in there.
They're so small, you got to suck it out of them. You can't hardly pour it out to start with.
And he said this one guy, you know, he watched them, and it was quite a conversation that went on. He had another alcoholic friend with him, and they were very inquisitive as what they were doing. And he had one of those little ounce bottles half full left, and he put that in his pocket, and he said they had to ask him, what are you going to do with that? And he said, I'm going to have a drink when I get home. You know, well, that's normal social drinking. Yeah. Now that is normal. And anything other than that is abnormal. Yeah. So he says that this is the manifestation of the allergy. This is the indicator of the difference, is the craving of the alcohol. This is not a physical manifestation as we can see with our eyes, but it is a physical manifestation. It's not visions of the eyes, but the craving of alcohol.
Also, the word craving deals with a physical thing.
Yeah.
Well, people say sometimes after they quit drinking, they craved alcohol for several months. Well, that really isn't true. Craving is a physical thing. The word craving always ties in with the body. You know, after they quit drinking, their mind might have been obsessed with the idea of drinking, or they might have desired to drink. But the craving comes only after we take a drink. And it is a physical thing. And even though the mind is saying, well, you got to stop, you got to stop, you got to go home and cut the grass, the physical factor is so strong that it overcomes the mind and says, well, we're going to go cut the grass after we have one more drink. And the craving occurs after we take the first drink. Now, he called it the phenomenon of craving. And the reason he referred to it as a phenomenon is he did not understand why it happens. Therefore, he said, this is only going to be my opinion. I can't state this as true fact. And back in 1933, 34, 35, in that era, they really didn't know why this occurred, so they referred to it as the phenomenon of craving. He speaks also of the chronic alcoholic. And this has bothered a lot of people as to what a chronic alcoholic is, and that simply means somebody that keeps doing it over and over.
More than once.
Anything you do more than once over and over is chronic, whether it's alcoholism or whatever it might be. So the guy that keeps getting drunk from time to time, he's a chronic alcoholic. Normal social drinkers just don't get drunk over and over and over. Let's flip over to Roman numeral page 28 for a moment. The doctor begins to describe different alcoholics. And he says the classification of alcoholics seems most difficult. And in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We're all familiar with this type. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never a decision.
This is type one.
There is a type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment.
This is type two.
There is a type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger.
Type three.
There is the manic depressive type, who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written.
Type four.
Now, this next type I always felt fit me almost exactly. It said, then there are types entirely normal in every respect, except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people.
He's a type five.
And I used to read that and I'd think, well, how did they know me so well? Now, the doctor says all five of these, and many others, have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Now, what the doctor does, he recognizes that we don't all do the same thing always after we take a drink. You know, if every one of we alcoholics here today, if we should take a drink this afternoon, God forbid that we don't, but if we did, we wouldn't all do exactly the same thing. Now, one of us would probably get over in the corner and start crying in his beer. Oh, boo-hoo-hoo. World is not treating me right at all. Another one would get out in the middle of the floor and he'd go to hooping and hollering and cutting up and dancing and telling jokes. Two of them would be over in the corner. Hell, they'd be in a fight within 30 minutes. And two more would be in another corner and one of them trying to put the make on the other one. You know, we tend to do those things after we have a drink or two. We would do different things, but there's one thing that we all would do. We would start looking for a second drink. The craving would develop, and we would have to have a second, and a third, and a fourth, and a fifth, and on until we're drunk and we're sick and in all kinds of trouble. Now, the intensity of the allergy may be different in some of us. For instance, the allergy is so pronounced in me that if I would take a drink this afternoon, by midnight, I've done found a cop and I'm in jail somewhere. I've gone through a fifth of whiskey by midnight and I've done had it. Some of you may have a drink today and two drinks tomorrow and three drinks the next day. And it may be 10 days or 2 weeks before you found a cop and you're in jail. But it really doesn't make any difference whether it takes 10 hours, 10 days, or 10 weeks. If we take a drink today, we trigger the allergy. We're unable to stop drinking, and sooner or later, we end up drunk, sick, and in all kinds of trouble. Nor does it seem to make any difference when this became apparent in our lifetime. You know, I drank alcohol for 26 years. I never remember drinking one drink of anything that had alcohol in it. Oh, surely somewhere I had one can of beer or one shot of whiskey. But if I did, I don't ever remember it. From the first drink I ever took, the craving was so pronounced that I had to have a second drink almost immediately. Never have I known normal social drinking. Some of you may have for a period of time. Some of you may have had relative-free drinking for a year, 5, 10, 8, 15, or 20. But then somewhere down the line, you lost control of the amount you consume after you started drinking. And it really doesn't make any difference whether it was there from the first drink or whether it was 10 years later. The fact remains that if we take a drink today, we trigger the allergy and we end up drunk and sick and in all kinds of trouble. I know this is true. If that wasn't true, we would not be sitting in this room today. We would be out there drinking alcohol and still having fun with it. So even though the degree of the allergy and its intensity may vary with each of us, the end result will always be the same. The phenomenon of craving develops after we take the first drink. And even though we do for different things after we start, that is the one thing we have in common today. Now, what we need to do today, I think, is start looking at the things we have in common. So many of us come into AA and we say, well, that guy has been in jail 30 times and I've only been there twice, so I'm different. Or she's been divorced 4 times and I've only had 1 and I'm different. The thing we have in common is not what we do after we drink. The thing we have in common is this allergy that pronounces itself or manifests itself as the phenomenon of craving, and it makes us virtually impossible to stop after we take the first drink. All that other stuff is beside the point.
Okay. He gives us an answer here. This phenomenon, as we suggested, may be, he says, may be the manifestation of the allergy, which differentiates these people and sets them apart in a distinct entity. It has never been by any treatment which we are familiar permanently eradicated. The only relief is to suggest its entire absence. And here, we're going to find Dr. Silkworth comes down. And this is real simple. And I think maybe that's the great difficulty of it, is so simple. Now here today, here at Medical Science Today, as we as far as the progress in treating the human beings, we know that we're allergic to a lot of different things. And about the only thing that the field of medicine can do is they take a certain test, trying to determine what that is, and then they pinpoint what you're allergic to. And after they pinpoint what you're allergic to, you spend a lot of money, you have a lot of tests, and then after they find out what you're allergic to, the doctor says, you know, I believe you ought to leave that alone. That, you know, he don't really cure you. He can't. And it's the same way with this allergy. If you're allergic to alcohol and it's manifested by the craving of alcohol, if you never take the first drink, you will never crave the second drink. That is simple. That's simple. That's bottom line.
The fact that I'm allergic to alcohol, I think I need to understand that and why I'm allergic to it.
Yeah.
But the fact that I'm allergic to it and know that I am does not really cure me of alcoholism. The only thing I have to do to not have the allergy hurt me is just don't take the first drink. But it seems as though there's something wrong with me that keeps me going back and taking the first drink. Now, quitting ain't the problem. Lord, it's easy to quit drinking.
Anybody
can quit drinking. Just slap a cop and you'll quit drinking, I'll guarantee it.
Ha ha ha.
starting is the problem.
That's right.
If we could stop starting, we'd be okay. But there seems to be something within us that keeps us going back and starting the rat race over and over again. I have a friend who is allergic to, of all things, fish. And when he eats fish, his throat swells up and he almost chokes to death. And every time he eats fish, it's a trip to the hospital. Now, there's no way that the fish could hurt him and cause his throat to swell up if he didn't eat fish. But there's something else wrong with that guy, too. Every once in a while, his mind tells him that it's okay to eat fish. And he seems to be unable to recall with sufficient force the suffering and pain and humiliation of the last trip to the hospital. And his mind said, it'll work this time. You can have a piece of fish and you'll be all right. And he eats the fish, and then the fish triggers the allergy. So the allergy is not his problem. His problem is his mind keeps telling him he can eat fish. And Dr. Silkworth was a sharp cookie. Because he describes the other half of our disease. We go back one page to Roman numeral 26 again. Let's do this. He says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. Now, you know, a lot of people say, well, the reason I drink is because I love the taste of alcohol. And I don't think I would argue with anybody whether they love the taste or not. I love the taste of cold beer. Always have all my life. But I also love the taste of cold mountain spring water. And I never remember sitting down and drinking a case of cold mountain spring water. Somewhere back when I was a kid growing up, I always felt like I was on the outside of the crowd looking in. I wanted to be a part of, but didn't seem to be able to be. I always knew that whatever I said or whatever I did would be the wrong thing. And people would laugh and I would be embarrassed. And I just never did seem to fit anywhere I went. And one night somebody gave me a drink of alcohol. And it was moonshine. And it went into my system. And that great feeling I described a while ago took place. Over my lips, and they got that hot feeling. My teeth went up and down. My cheeks went in and out. My tongues, it went up here, and I swallowed it. And I damn near choked to death when I swallowed it, just like liquid fire. But as I was choking to death, I felt that chest begin to grow and expand. And I felt those arms get longer and longer, and those legs get longer and longer. And I could go back to the dance where the kids were, and I asked a girl to dance for the first time in my life, and I knew she wouldn't say no. And I knew that I'd be able to dance with her. And I took her home from the dance and got her in the back seat of the car and did some of those things that, you know, that we like to do. And I'd never been able to do that before. That night, alcohol did something for me I could not do for myself. Alcohol made me fit. It gave me feelings that I'd never had before. And it allowed me to function in the manner that I'd never been able to do before. And Dr. Silkworth says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by I loved it. I loved what alcohol did for me. And I couldn't hardly wait until the second time to see if it would do that again. And by golly, it did. And then the third time and the fourth time and the fifth time, and alcohol became the answer to the problems that I had. And the doctor says the sensation we get from it is so elusive that while we admit it is injurious, we cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. You know, people begin to say to me, Charlie, you can't drink. You're drinking too much. It's destroying your life, your marriage, your job, and everything. And even though I could from time to time see what alcohol was doing to me and admit, yeah, it's hurting me, I really could not accept that in my life because alcohol had become such a great thing that I really could not differentiate the true from the false. And I think that's the thing we got to understand today about alcoholism. If we are to help the alcoholic, the alcoholic cannot see where he is. You know, we talk about the disease of denial, the professional people do today. He's not denying. You can't deny something if you don't know what it is. And the true alcoholic doesn't know what he's got. He can't differentiate the truth from the false. He thinks that everybody else is out of step. His life is the only normal one. And the doctor describes the way we feel. He says, we're restless and irritable and discontented. And all my life I've been restless and irritable
and discontented. All my life I've been filled with shame and fear and guilt and remorse over the things that I would do during my drinking and etc. And I would run around sober and I didn't feel good. And I wanted to feel better. And maybe I had begun to recognize what alcohol does to me. And my mind would say, well, Charlie, if you'd have a drink, you'd feel better. And maybe my mind said, no, you can't drink. You know, you quit drinking, you swore off drinking. But after a while, I feel so lousy that the mind says, well, you might as well get drunk as feel the way you are. It couldn't possibly make you feel any worse. And the doctor describes this when he says, we're restless, irritable, and discontented. Unless we could again experience a sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. The sense of ease and comfort. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. Now, after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, you know, after we have taken the drink, then the phenomenon of craving develops. Then they pass through the well-known stages of a spree. They're unable to stop drinking. And they emerge from that spree remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. And this is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. Now that whole paragraph we've been reading has dealt with the way the mind feels, not the way the body feels. And he describes the restlessness and the irritability and the discontent, and the mind searching for something to make it feel better. And after a while, it latches on the idea of taking a drink. And then the mind tells the body to take the drink. And then the body takes the drink. And then the physical allergy comes into being and we're unable to stop. And then we end up drunk and sick and in all kinds of trouble. Just like my friend who is allergic to fish. You know, he's free from fish and he's restless and he's irritable and he's discontented. And the mind begins to toy with the idea of a piece of fish. And after a while, the mind says, it won't hurt you this time. And the mind gives the body permission to eat the fish, and the fish triggers the allergy, and then he's in a hell of a shape. And we have exactly the same thing. And the doctor is describing now the state of the mind preceding the first drink, the thing that leads us back to trying over and over and over again.
At this point, you described a total picture. The body and the mind. He has given us a triggering mechanism, and our book says that we have to discuss the body and the mind, and later on our book is going to bring out the point, and we'll get a little ahead, that probably the greatest problem of the alcoholic will center in the mind rather than the body. Most of all of our recovery and all the work we're going to work on dealing with the mind, this is where we're going to find the answer, within the mind, not the body. You know, once we're allergic to alcohol, we'll always be allergic to alcohol. In fact, this will get worse as we get older, whether we drink or not. But we can recover within the mind. This we're going to develop going through these two areas. And we're going to find that the solution is to be with the mind. We're later going to come up with the idea, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us in the mind, not the body. Based on this information, as we see it, we don't know. He said there's nothing we can do about the body. The answer we're going to find is going to be within the mind. Yeah, I'll go.
Okay, now we have a piece of information that we have taken from some medical facts and medical journals. We want to assure you that we recognize that this is not AA material we're getting ready to present to you. But what we're going to show you proves the doctor's opinion. And I think it's so interesting and so important that all of us really need to see it and understand why we are allergic to alcohol,
and why we seem to be unable to live without taking that first drink, left on our own resources. You know, the mind and the body are wonderful mechanisms. When we put anything into our body, I don't care what kind of food, beverage, substance, poison, or whatever it is, the mind and the body has the ability to recognize what's put in there. And the mind and the body produces certain enzymes to get rid of stuff. Now, back in the doctor's opinion days, they didn't understand about enzymes. They really didn't understand metabolism. They really didn't know how this stuff breaks down in the body. But for instance, today, when I put a piece of steak in my body, through the stomach and the brain, we figure out what's there. And in the brain, we'll signal certain organs of the body to produce enzymes necessary to break that piece of steak down. And it will break it down into the useful and unuseful items. The proteins, the amino acids, the vitamins can be extracted from it and used by the body. The byproducts, the unusable items, are dissipated through the urinary and the intestinal tract, and we get rid of them. And the body has the ability to do this with whatever goes in it. Sometimes it's overwhelmed by a poison, and it doesn't have time to take care of it, and we die from it. But normally, you know, we can metabolize and get rid of most what we put in our system. Alcohol is the same way. Now, on your chart, and you have a handout sheet, yours is going to be just a little different from our chart. We've made a few modifications to it, so we'll go through it together, but they're close enough, I don't think you'll have any problem. It's going to show 9 people, these normal drinkers, these temperate drinkers, social drinkers, or we refer to them 9 people who are at ease with alcohol. Alcohol is no problem for them. They take a drink of alcohol in their system. The stomach and the body figures out what's, or the mind figures out what's there. And the mind then signals certain organs of the body to begin the enzyme production. The enzyme production then begins to work upon the alcohol, and it begins to metabolize and break it down. In the first stage, it's broken down into material called acetaldehyde. Then after a while, it's broken down into diacetic acid, and then into acetone. And in the final stage, it's broken down into a simple carbohydrate, which is water, sugar, and carbon dioxide. Now, the sugar can be used by the body. The sugar is pure energy. It has calories. The body can burn it to function, and it can store the excess as fat to be used at a later date. An interesting fact is they're what we call empty calories. They have none of the amino acids. They have none of the vitamins, none of the things necessary for life. The practicing alcoholic, about half of his calories is coming from the pure sugar that is extracted from the alcohol, and he's really suffering malnutrition because he's not getting his amino acids and vitamins as he should. But for the normal social drinker, this process takes place at the rate of 1 ounce per hour. Theoretically speaking, and we know it's only theoretical because it depends on the body and the size of the body and different people metabolize in different ways, but theoretically speaking, the average social drinker can drink 1 ounce of alcohol per hour, metabolize it, get rid of it, and not get drunk. Now, 1 person out of 10 is not at ease with alcohol. He is at dis, which means back, or to separate from. And that's all the word disease means, something that separates you from the norm. 1 person out of 10 is separated from the norm by a disease called alcoholism. And he is the alcoholic on the left-hand side of the sheet. He takes a drink of alcohol, and the same things begin happening. The mind figures out what's there, signals the organs of the body, the enzyme production begins, the alcohol is metabolized, broken down into acetaldehyde. Then into diacetic acid, and then into acetone. Now, it seems as though in the body of the alcoholic, the enzymes necessary to break it from acetone to the simple carbohydrate are not there in the same quantities and qualities as they are in the body of the non-alcoholic. Therefore, it is in the body of the alcoholic for a longer period of time as acetone. Perhaps the alcoholic can break it down at the rate of 3/4 of an ounce per hour, or maybe a 1/2 ounce per hour, or maybe 1/4 of an ounce per hour, depending upon what our metabolic rate is, depending upon the stages of alcoholism we're in. Now, the medical profession has proven beyond any shadow of a doubt that acetone ingested into the human body that lays there for an appreciable period of time will produce an actual physical craving for more of the same. In the non-alcoholic, it goes through the acetone stage rapidly enough that the craving is never pronounced enough to demand the second drink. But in the body of the alcoholic, since the rate is slower, it is there for a longer period of time, the physical craving develops, and the body begins to say, "Say, fella, I need some more of what you just put in me a while ago." Now, we've still got some of the acetone from the first drink in our system when that occurs. We reach out and take the second drink, and the same metabolism rate is there, and we add more acetone into the system, and we still got some of the first drink there. Now we've got some of the second drink there. The acetone level goes up and the craving becomes stronger. Now, we said we were going to have two and then we were going to go home and mow the grass. But by the time the second drink is in there, the body is now saying, not just I want some more, it's saying, give me some more of this stuff. And we put the third drink in there. We got a little of the first, most of the second, and all of the third in here now. And the acetone level goes up. And the mind said, man, you got to get up and go home and mow the grass. And the body said, to hell with that, let's have another one. And by midnight, we've had 10 or 15 or 20, and the acetone level has kept going up and up and up, and we're drunk, and we land in the gutter, and we've been run over by a car, and it broke our leg, and we've puked all over ourselves. And somebody said, what can we do for you? And we say, my God, give me another drink. We never get all we want to drink. The normal social drinker gets all they want every damn time they drink. I can never remember in getting all I wanted to drink. Oh, yeah. Yeah, lots of times had more than I needed, but I never remember getting all that I wanted. That craving intensifies. The more we put in, the higher the craving becomes. Now, I think what is so interesting that the medical profession has proven today is that acetone ingested in the body is a destroyer of human tissue. And the two organs of the body that this acetone seems to destroy the most rapidly are the liver and the pancreas. And what they've proven today, the two organs of the body that produce the enzymes necessary to break this stuff down, are the liver and the pancreas. And as we drink more and more and more, we destroy the liver and the pancreas. Therefore, the enzyme production becomes less and less. The acetone level continually gets higher and higher, and we are in the grips of a progressive disease called alcoholism. Yeah, never gets any better. We also know that as we get older, the level of production of everything goes down. You know, I wish to hell it didn't, but it does, you know. And the level of production of these enzymes go down as we get older. Even with foods, you know, when we're 50 and 60, we can't eat the same kind of foods in the same quantities we ate when we were 25 and 30. So as we get older, the enzyme production goes down, and our disease becomes more and more progressive due to age. If I would take a drink today, I would not start where I left off 15 years ago. I would start at a much more advanced stage because my enzyme production will be less because of age itself.
Now, this is what triggers the allergy. Then that leads to the well-known spree. And then I emerge from the spree remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. And the doctor said, I'm going to repeat this cycle over and over and over and over unless I can experience an entire psychic change. Now, the instant he said psychic, he left the body and he went to the mind. Some way I've got to learn to live where I don't have to take that first drink, where I won't be restless, where I won't be irritable, where I won't be discontented, and I can be sober and be happy and peaceful and serene at the same time. Otherwise, the mind leads me back to the first drink, which triggers the allergy.
Okay, now, as we understand the allergy, then we come over to this side, which is the mind. This is the physical, and this is the mental. This is the main problem. Over here, he describes, he said, we become restless, irritable, and discontent. And this little barometer, each and every one of us, each and every individual, support of human life, we have some very complex emotions. Just like we have a very complex chemical life, which mankind doesn't completely understand, we also, the great unknown area is our emotional lives. We have we're going to be talking more in depth about this. All this is necessary to make up the human being. And in these components, no one is immune from emotional problems. In fact, you know, we alcoholics, everybody has emotional problems. They cause all of our human problems are born right in here. And everybody has them. And he said, we become restless and irritable and discontented, and we build up on these emotions become a problem for us. Some people, have a nervous breakdown. Some people causes crime. All kind of problems are caused by this. But I think the majority of our society just walks around kind of half sick and don't do nothing about it. But we alcoholics, somewhere during our maturity, in bypassing our lives while having one of these emotional problems, we happened to be a drinking occasion, or we had a few drinks. And when we took these few drinks, these few drinks came back over, and alcohol is a depressant. It depressed our emotions. And as the end results, we felt better. Now we have another part of our being coming into play. Now once a person has a problem and you find a solution for it, we have a memory bank. And we memorize the solution. The mind seems to write it down. And that's a great part of a mind. The mind writes down the successful solution, and the next time we have a problem, our mind will refeed us our old solution. Say if your TV broke, and this is people don't understand it, and it's not, addiction is not bad. It's a part of the human process. It's a part of every successful life. If your TV broke today, you would have a problem, and chances are you would go around and cause. If you didn't know anybody in this area, you were new, you would have a problem. You would hunt for a solution, and you'd probably go into the Yellow Pages, and you would find somebody to come over and fix it for you. He'd come over and do you a good job, and your TV would be fine. And 6 months later, when your TV broke again, you would not go back in the Yellow Pages. You would remember the man you used the last time. So you add these two things together, you know, broken TV, certain repairman. Now when the alcoholic builds up, he reaches over and takes a few drinks and depresses his emotion. The next time he builds up, the doctor said he remembers the sense and ease and comfort that came the last time from a few drinks of alcohol. And he becomes restless, irritable, discontent. And this line here is obsession. We're going to be talking about that. You know, all action that the body takes, the body cannot take a drink. In fact, the body can't do anything. All action is born in thought. Any actions we take has to be preceded by a thought. So this thought to drink overcomes all other thoughts. And once we build up to this pressure point, it triggers the idea to drink for the relief. And we reach over and take the first few drinks. It does come back and depress us. But once we take these few drinks set off the physical part of our illness. Once the alcohol gets into the system, it becomes a physical problem. And the phenomenon of craving develops, and we go through the well-known spree. And down here at the bottom, we emerge remorseful. And down here is where we alcoholics repeat our national anthem, "I will never do that again."
I'll never take another drink as long as I live.
And slowly we start another build-up, gradually another build-up to this point, trigger the idea to drink again, take a few drinks again, sets off the body over. He said this is repeated over and over again, the mind triggering the body, and the body in reverse triggering the mind. Because the more the mind makes us take this drink, the chemical deficiency gets worse, the craving gets harder, the drinking gets harder. And as the drinking gets harder, we got more problems over on this side to re-trigger it back. And we have summed this up. You know, if you've got an allergy to alcohol, you can't drink safely. And if you've got the obsession, then you can't quit. And we can see where he's coming with the first problem statement. If you can't drink because of the allergy and can't quit because of the obsession, then you are powerless over alcohol. Now, once Dr. Silkworth gave us the problem, then we found a solution. And there is a solution here. Once you understand the problem, there's an answer somewhere. For many years before I understood this, and I, like most alcoholics, I had a problem and I didn't understand it. When you have a problem and you don't understand it, you try solutions, all different types of solutions. You don't know what it is, but you just try what you can. And for many years, I tried to control my drinking while drinking. It didn't do too good. You know, I said, and I realize now because of the craving, I'm going to drink 3 and stop, 4 and stop, you know. But it never did work on a continuous basis. After many years, I finally failed at that. I didn't know anything about the allergy. But after about 14 or 15 years of drinking, I finally determined that I couldn't drink. So then I came over here and tried to handle my disease in the mind. I said, well, I can't drink, so I'm going to just go. You know, alcoholics, one thing we're going to find out is very essential to being an alcoholic, and that's willpower. And we alcoholics are full of that stuff. When an alcoholic makes up his mind, that's his number one weapon. And when he decided to get his willpower out, he really means business. So I decided that, you know, I went over here and I put old Will in there. And I said, I quit. I still had the obsessions of drink come at me constantly each day for that 9 months. But I blocked them out with Will. And finally one of them little devils got through and I was gone again. So you can never be successful here, and you can't really be successful here. But once Dr. Silkworth gave us the bill, he talked about a psychic change. If we could live below this line, if we could live down here or even just right here, anywhere below this line, we would never find it necessary to take the first drink. We would never set off the allergy in the body. Came to believe in a power greater than ourselves. It changes within the personality, the attitude. This, we believe, is the solution to alcoholism. And this was based on Dr. Silkworth's work. Dr. Silkworth was the first person to explain, and our book gives us the exact nature of the problem.
Now then, we can begin to see that even though we have a twofold illness, a physical allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind, that recovery will come about through the mind only. And he refers to this as a psychic change. And over on Roman numeral number 29, XX1X, the doctor said, when I have an uplift, I often think of another case brought in by a physician prominent in New York.
The patient had made his own diagnosis and decided his situation hopeless, had hidden in a deserted barn, determined to die. He was rescued by a searching party and in desperate condition brought to me. Following his physical rehabilitation, he had a talk with me in which he frankly stated he thought the treatment a waste of effort. Unless I could assure him, which no one ever had, that in the future he would have the willpower to resist the impulse to drink. His alcoholic problem was so complex and his depression so great that we felt his only hope would be through what we then called moral psychology. And we doubted if even that would have any effect. Now, the doctor came awful close to saying that his recovery would be through spirituality. But in those days, if you're a medical doctor, you don't talk about spirituality. So they used the term moral psychology, which still deals with the mind. So the doctor again is stating that his only hope for recovery would be through the mind, but then the doctor realizes that they couldn't bring this about in this fellow. It's a hopeless thing as far as the doctor could actually see. We've looked at the disease now. For the first time, we see the problem. We really see the problem of the disease of alcoholism. The physical allergy of the body, coupled with the obsession of the mind, that leads us to a hopeless condition of the mind and of the body.
Dr. Silkworth, you know, it was his opinion. Now, you got to think, you know, what this was based on, that he stuck his neck out. You know, it wasn't but 40 people. And this was a very radical thing when it would come out in the big book in 1939. And I guess, you know, he stuck his neck out, and he gave this to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's very peculiar, as we noticed in studying the big red book. And we can see where Dr. Silkworth was at that time. Because in 1939, when it came out, the doctor's opinion was not signed. Dr. Silkworth didn't sign this. You know, this was finally accepted, what, in 1956, that alcoholism was a disease many years later. But thank God all the work proves the great work of Dr. Silkworth. He is really the father. All of us in Alcoholics Anonymous or sober, it was based on his discovery, his opinion, in which we all recovered. The doctor's opinion is the basis of our recovery.